I'm fortunate that I am able to work as hard as I want, but that means sometimes I need to get up early, get some work done before the kids wake up so that I can be there to give them a kiss, give them a cuddle, tell them I love them, tell them that they're going to have a fantastic day. I remember saying it today, be the best Mr. Krieger you can be. And they'll be hearing that from me day after day after day after day.
Welcome to another episode of Higher Learning with me, your host, Oz Rashid. This is the show where we talk to executives and founders who are changing their companies and industries and learn from them what they uniquely see that others don't when it comes to identifying top talent. For all our longtime listeners, thank you for your support. If this is your first time listening, please make sure to subscribe on Apple and Spotify and leave us a rating. Today, we are joined by a very special guest. We are joined by Duncan Krieger. He is based out of the UK, and he's CEO and founder of a company called Tap. Duncan, how you doing, man?
Very, very well. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Of course. I'm pretty excited to have you, bud. I'm really excited to learn from you a little bit about the real estate industry, a little bit about the professional community in the UK. I want to start here, though, because I want to talk about Tap. Can you tell us about what Tap does, and then ultimately, what was the journey to starting this company, like your entrepreneurial journey?
Yeah, sure. So Tap is a mortgage lender in the UK. So in simple terms, we lend money secured against property, real estate, as you guys call it, on residential and commercial assets, ranging from small little high street properties all the way up to large office buildings and those that are being converted from residential to commercial or commercial to residential. So since founding Tab in 2018, we have lent almost £600 million. And the majority of that was split 50-50 between residential and commercial assets, as I mentioned. Currently, we have a loan book of about £250 million because our short-term loans redeem all the time. Typically 1 year is what we've done since inception. And we fund those loans through a mixture of private investors who come to our platform, sign up as investors, go through automated AML and KYC checks, and then have access to these type of products, and also through some of the largest banks in the UK. So we have a £300 million private securitization facility, and that allows us to write bridging loans, development loans, and long-term 10-year commercial mortgages. So quite a lot going on at Tab. I think the other thing that hopefully we'll touch on a lot is our ambitions to open up real estate investments to a much broader range of people. So under a term called fractional ownership, we've been opening up different types of real estate investments, both long-term, sort of long, boring hold type investments, as well as value add transactions where we try to buy something, add some value and sell it for a profit. And all of those property investments we open up to investors in the same way as we do with our loan products. So that's a kind of really quick whistle stop tour of what Tab does. And if you want, I'll tell you a bit more about how I got
there. I had a couple of follow-ups and then I do want to hear about like what was kind of the aha moment here for you. But super interesting industry. Sounds like you're democratizing real estate investment, which is like, I think a lot of people look at as this thing that if you're like only the super wealthy do, but it's something that, you know, everybody, especially if you have a fractional model, can get involved in and get a lot of the benefits of one of the best areas to invest in from a long-term perspective. So I think that's amazing. I definitely want to dive deeper into that. I'm interested. You said the 50-50 commercial versus residential split. Is that like an intentional strategy or is that just kind of like, that seems very clean or did it? Is that something that's just kind of worked out that way as you look back over time at the metrics?
I mean, the answer to that is that we're open to good assets, good borrowers. So I think the main message here is we don't have a sort of one-track focus, which a lot of lending businesses do. You know, private credit is absolutely huge now. When I started my first business 20 years ago, it was very unusual to have private credit. Really, you relied on the banks, the challenger banks, and some sort of boutique lending houses. Now it's absolutely blown up in the US, but in the UK there are lots of family offices doing different types of lending strategies because lending against real estate's always been a good risk-adjusted return. But the point is, we're open to good people and good assets, and that's led us to having, you know, I mean, actually, as we sit here today, we're sort of tipped the balance slightly on residential loans because we've invested in our technology heavily, and we'll talk about that and the work we're doing with AI as well on a risk and underwriting perspective. But I do look at the data all the time. And actually, we're sort of creeping up closer to 60% residential at the moment. But that's because I think other lenders in the UK space have got some confidence back in the commercial market. So we see that, you know, the metrics swing. But of the 575 odd million pounds worth of loans that we've written to date, there is almost a 50-50 split. And that's just something I'm sort of interested in myself and always keen to communicate.
Super fascinating. So you opened the business in 2018. Sounds like you've been a longtime entrepreneur in different industries. What kind of was like the driving force for you to say, this is a problem I want to get involved with, I want to jump into? Like, what was kind of like the moment where you decided I wanted to do this?
Yeah, I think to be honest, the moment for starting Tab again. So I had a lending business, founded in my early 20s, pretty much in my bedroom. That business went really, really well, just writing one good loan at a time, figuring out who to lend to, where to get money from, how to underwrite cases, and more importantly, how to get your capital back. I was fortunate enough to sell that business in 2014, a private equity-backed transaction. I stayed on board as the managing director of that lending business until 2016. And at that point, I decided I wanted to go back out on my own, be the master of my own destiny, and had really good conversations with the owners of the business at the time. And I had to take 2 years out of the industry. So I wasn't allowed to do anything lending or finance broking related. And the aha moment, I think, because I haven't been asked this question for a long time, was fractional investment in real estate. So if people can club together and do crowdfunding in all different types of asset classes, why can't we crowdfund ownership of assets? And if somebody owns 1% of that property, they should be entitled to 1% of that property's income. And a lot of the skills that I'd obtained through building a lending business, managing private investor capital, reporting to people on a monthly basis, building technology around it, I felt were transferable. And I feel like the market was starting to evolve. So, you know, I always say this, but you don't buy a gold bar and put it under your bed anymore if you decide you want to invest in gold. You take your phone out, you look at what the live price is, and you can buy as much as you like, and you can sell it as quickly. And that's my vision for real estate. So it started as maybe we should create the stock market for property, so that each individual property is listed like a company's listed on the stock exchange. And if somebody wants to invest in that property, they can look at the financial accounts and the tenancy information, the valuations, the all of the sort of available data that one can obtain now. And I set about starting Tab with that in mind. And that's really where the aha moment came from. And I've always felt in every business decision, timing is everything. So important. And what I realized about fractional investment in real estate is timing wasn't perfect. As in, I don't want to spend all my time and money educating the market. I'm happy the market's big enough. The size of the opportunity is big enough. So my thing was, let's get up and running. Let's prove we know what we're doing. Let's build a good brand. Let's build some trust. And then when the market catches up with me, we'll be ready to pounce.
So I love that. And I was going to ask you about where you think the future of real estate is going overall, but it sounds like you have a pretty well-defined idea of that. So I want to dive in a little bit to the timing aspect, because that's something that I'm actually going through myself right now. As you know, we have our services business, MSH. It's been around for 15 years. We feel like we've been very innovative in that space through the way that we kind of work with our clients and deliver, you know, whether it be candidates or process or technology, whatever it may be. But the software that we've built, it, in my mind, this is where the industry is going, right? It's ultimately going to be there. It's going to be there for the business. It's going to have a humongous impact in creating more certainty in hiring. But what I find is that I'm having I have to make sure that the timing is right, because people don't move at the speed you want them to. I mean, if we even look at AI, right? The technology that's going on with AI right now, the innovation is way out in front of what the actual adoption cycles are, what people are ready for and ready to consume. And so one of the things as a founder that you've got to really figure out is, you know, making that timing right. Or to your point, what's our interim strategy to kind of build our business and get it off the floor, give people something they understand and they know, right? And then start to move them on this journey of educating them and showing them what it could be, right? And then when they're ready, boom, you're there to take advantage of it. So just don't know if you have any thoughts on that or if you thought I hit
the nail. I think that's exactly what I'm saying. And it's super interesting. I met this morning with a technology firm that I know really well. In fact, they do sort of keeping companies, their services online, keeping your emails and all of that type. I've known these guys for a very long time. They looked after one of my original businesses. We're talking about AI, as I do over any lunch or breakfast or podcast that I go on to at the moment. And we were talking about how powerful it is. And I was saying, you know, everyone must be driving you mad about this. And he said, no, they're not. He said, you wouldn't believe how many of our customers still have physical servers in their office. You know, they've operated successful businesses for the last 15 years. Everything works. They're not looking to upgrade their systems immediately. They're not looking to go up into the cloud or to have access on all devices. People are pretty happy with what they've got, a large majority. But also specifically on AI, what he was saying is businesses love it, but they don't want to pay for it at the moment. So they're saying, yeah, Microsoft gave it to me for free. Everybody loves it. Game changer. And then they say, right, it's $200 a month per user. And then people are like, no, switch it off. Don't want it. Don't need it. And that surprises me because I'm personally subscribing to every different platform I can at the moment, trying to learn how it works from Perplexity to ChatGPT and for all these different tools that are making me better and more productive. But I do understand that there are challenges on the other side. And so I think the point was he's saying, yeah, exactly what you said, the technology is moving super fast, but the adoption isn't super fast.
No.
You know, for me, I think there is a big, when I translate that to my own business, I think, do people think investing in grade A property from the palm of your hand is a good idea? Yes, I think they do. Do they want to do it? Yes. Are they ready to take out their phone right now and deposit cash? Possibly not. You know, what do they want to see? They want to see a track record. They want the app to be seamless. They want it to be look beautiful. They want it to be super quick so they don't get bored after 3 seconds or 5 seconds because people have got used to this scroll nature. And I think all these pieces of the puzzle need to be in place. And I think that's one thing that all entrepreneurs need to understand. It's that, you know, timing is always now, but also make sure you're not, you know, what I was keen not to do was take a load of investment, which I could have raised really easily, have give myself a 12-month horizon where I need to hit these milestones in order to keep raising more funds. Otherwise, the business would miss the train. So for me, it was about investing my own money, going slow, looking at the P&L, making sure we can afford the commitments that we're taking on board. And I'm pleased to say the business has grown from strength to strength, month to month. And we're building a war chest for ourselves to build out the product.
That's a conversation. You and I have a lot more parallels than I think I even realized. I'm also investing my own money. And I think that's the right thing to do because now you don't have the gun to your head and you can kind of massage the timing a little bit more because and same thing with you. You just said, you know, people, do they think that fractional investment is a good thing? Do they want to do it from their phone? Are they going to take it out and deposit it and do it right now? Those are three different questions. I know that people want better hiring outcomes. I think that they will use a tool that will help them that. Are they going to pull out their credit card or are they going to want to pay money for that right now? That's what we're trying to figure out. And so that's why you have to be very smart about your investment strategy and your go-to-market strategy and how you educate these customers. Because the reality of the situation is some of these great companies that have excelled and become huge, you know, they have this like revisionist history of like, oh, it's an amazing entrepreneur who built the most amazing business model and built this team and did XYZ. You know what really helped? The right timing or the right, like you got lucky in a lot of these cases where either you were treading water for a little while and then boom, you were ready when the market was ready or you just entered the market at the exact right time. I just
think I want that window of potential luck to be wide. You know, I don't want to get lucky in the first 6 months, otherwise I'm out of business, because that could happen. But I'd rather be here for 5 years. And then I've got, you know, 5 years, 60 months to get lucky. And then, yeah, so I think it's interesting. Timing is everything. The market changes. You need to ride your luck. And I definitely subscribe to the harder you work, the luckier you get, the more rooms you get a foot into, the more conversations you have, the more podcasts you go on to. I do feel like there's that chance that you might meet someone along the way who buys what you're doing, who wants to help. And that's why I'm always so open. I want to share everything I can in the hope that we move forward.
I love that. I call it increasing your luck surface, right? And that's the more, you're more likely to have that timing work out or things work out. So I love that. I want to ask you something real quick before we jump into a little bit more about you personally. I know there was some recent legislation passed in the UK around budget. And I know from all my entrepreneur friends who are out there that it was a pretty unfavorable just in terms of being able to, you know, build your own business and get the returns that that risk usually entails, at least here in the US. So I'm just interested, could you tell us a little bit about that policy and then kind of your take on it as an entrepreneur and somebody that lives in the UK?
Yeah, I can tell you more about my take on it. And my take really is just in general, but in relation to this as well, is to play with the hand that you're dealt. And I think it's way too easy. I mean, I'm really against any type of excuses for productivity. I think that there are a million reasons why people will say it's bad, it's not good, it's unhelpful, they're doing it to get me. My attitude is, how do I use this to my advantage? So first I see people, undoubtedly people will want to leave the UK. You know, there have been a government, I mean, this happens in politics and you'll know only too well about it on your side of the pond. It is, politicians get away with things that entrepreneurs wouldn't. If I came out and told my staff or my customers, I'll never put your pricing up, I'll always increase your wages, I'll always do these things which are keep voting for me. And then the day I get in the hot seat, I say, oh, by the way, I'm doing completely the opposite. I'd lose my job instantly. I'd lose my job, I'd lose my customers, I'd lose credibility, and we would go out of business. What I think highly frustrates me about politics is that on the way up, people will do and say whatever they have to get another vote. Then come D-Day, when you're sitting in the hot seat and you've got to make decisions, you go against everything that you said you would. All of your principles, all of your morals, everything goes out the window. And for that reason, I don't like to spend my time thinking too much about things that I can't change. So I like to spend my time thinking, right, what's the rules? How do I use this to my advantage? What's the chances it's going to change? And what I was going to say is that undoubtedly people will leave the UK. There will be waves of people who say, it's not cost effective for me. I'm sick of it. I'm going somewhere else. Firstly, where am I going to go? I've got a family here. I've got 4 children. We're all settled. We like being here. We travel lots anyway. So we're going to see different parts of the world. I don't want to move and I'm not considering moving, but what I think is great. The more people who go, the better. It gives me a much easier path to success. You know, the less people here fighting to grow companies and employ people, the better it is for me personally, in that we have a huge opportunity to pick up on these voids. And I just think tax in general is a necessary evil. You know, the UK, for example, has the NHS. A lot of the funding, a lot of the talk, a lot of the cost is about the NHS, which, by the way, is one of the largest employers on earth. The amount of people that they employ is staggering. The way that they try to run an organisation, I run an organisation of nearly 40 people. It's hard work keeping everybody in check, knowing where they are, you know, making sure they're adhering to policies and procedures, record keeping. So I do have some sympathy, actually. And I think the NHS is a massive benefit. And if it costs me 20% more or 10% more in tax, and I am definitely not in the majority here, then so be it, as long as I'm seeing positive change. And I do think, on the whole, the government, whether it's Labour or conservative. And they're both pretty much the same as far as I'm concerned. I do think, in general, they want to improve people's quality of life. When you're making decisions for everybody, you're going to upset some people and you're going to make some people happy. I mean, just as well, looking at the property market, looking at the real estate sector, there are some big negatives that will undoubtedly stifle the market. But there's also a big positive drive to build new homes, to house people that need homes, to fund the sectors like the housing sector and people who need it. So you can't give to everyone. And my attitude is, just tell me what's going on. Who's the president this week? Rip the plaster off. Give us the news so that we're not always living in what's going to happen next, what's going to happen, what's going to happen next. So I think now that our vote's over, your vote's over, I see a little bit more calm and stability already in that we've got the bad news out of the way. Let's see what the rules of the game are.
So I love the way that you just framed that. And the way what I always would tell people, and I got to be honest, sometimes I got to pull myself from this too, because it's hard sometimes with all the noise and all the things going on around you. I tend to take a similar mindset to you, but I always would say, don't complain about the rules of the game. Learn the rules and adapt to them and make them work for you. And if you spend your time doing that, you're going to be productive. You're going to get good outcomes. There's always going to be things holding you back, distractions. I love that you said no excuses for lack of productivity. And so that mindset has really helped me. I'm interested because you do have a very like positive mindset. And how has that helped you as an entrepreneur? Is that something that, like, do you think that you can be an entrepreneur that has kind of that pessimistic victim mentality, glass half empty type mindset and be successful? And if not, then how is that attributed to your success in terms of having the positivity?
I mean, I don't think it's helpful. I think there's sort of layers of positivity. You know, they say there's a fine line between ambition and greed. And I think with positivity, you can be blindly burying your head in the sand, thinking everything's going to be okay. Or you can be positive about taking steps every day to ensure that things don't go against you. I think, you know, being an entrepreneur to me is basically a problem solver. Thousands of decisions a day. How am I going to do this? What's going to happen if I don't? What's going to happen if I do? And I always look at the worst case scenario. So I think I have a skill, and I'm lucky that I was created this way, but I have a very positive outlook. And I often ask myself the question, what's the worst that can happen? What happens if this doesn't go my way? So I don't think it's easy to be, I feel like it would be harder for me to get out of bed every day if I thought today's going to be terrible. Because my attitude is when I wake up in the morning, I look outside and I've trained myself to think it's going to be an incredible day. Something good is going to happen to me today. And I think if you do the reverse of that and you wake up in the morning and say something bad is going to happen to me today, the chances of that happening are much greater than the person who says something good is going to happen today. I'm fortunate that when I open the curtains in the morning and I see the sun shining, whether it's cold and wet and we joked about it right at the beginning, or whether the sun's too hot to go outside, I see opportunity, I see life, I see fresh air, I see, you know, something positive to go out to. But I'm conscious that other people that I've grown up with, family, friends who are wired differently, can open the curtains and think it's cold and wet outside and I don't want to be there. So I like to ride it. I want to remind myself every day that I'm lucky that I think this way, something good's going to happen, get up a bit earlier, go and take yourself out of your comfort zone, try and meet someone, spark up a conversation, say hello, be nice. And those things have always worked really well for me.
Yeah, listen, you and I, we think a lot alike from a mindset perspective. I love that. You've said some really amazing things.
Finding the right talent for your team doesn't have to be a struggle. Meet Aon Hire, the world's first hiring experience management platform designed to transform the way you hire. Powered by AI, Aon Hire takes the hassle out of every step in the process. From smart resume analysis to customized interview questions, It saves you time, money, and effort. Plus, with real-time insights from every interview, you can quickly identify top candidates, reduce turnover, and stay on budget. And forget about note-taking. Aon Hire takes care of that for you. Ready to revolutionize your hiring process? Visit aonhire.com and get started today.
I want to ask you, because you have, like me as well, four kids. And yeah. Keeping that balanced, right? Threading the needle on giving what you need to give to your business to make sure you maximize that opportunity, but also making sure you give what you need to give to your kids to maximize their potential and who they are. How do you balance those things? Like, do you have a core philosophy around that? How do you do that?
Spend as much time with them as I can, first and foremost. So what I've done recently, and I think this has been a shift, obviously I haven't had four kids forever. It's more recently I've had two, gone to three, gone to four. I think one thing that I definitely would, you know, advise people that have got multiple kids is to try and spend time with your children on a one-to-one. I think you get much more out of even like a 15 minute, half an hour interaction where you get to sit down with one of your kids on their own. They get more from it, and I feel like I get more from it than just like I'm on the weekend, I'm going to take them all out for a couple of hours. It's a stress. So to me, it's about doing something every day. I'm fortunate that I am able to work as hard as I want, and I like working really hard, but that means sometimes I need to get up early, get some work done before the kids wake up so that I can be there to give them a kiss, give them a cuddle, tell them I love them, tell them that they're going to have a fantastic day, and all the things that we've talked about. And I guess it's subconscious, but you know, I say to some of the boys, and I remember saying it today, be the best Mr. Krieger you can be. And they'll be hearing that from me day after day after day after day. And I'll say to the boys, I just feel that you're going to have an amazing day today. And they're like, yeah, you know what? I am. So I think I'm trying to impart this way of thinking on them all the time, even subconsciously. And I like to try and spend as much time with them as I can and make time for them every single day. And I don't want to get to the end of the week and think, I wish I'd have done a bit more. I wish I'd have tried a bit harder because they grow up so fast.
Yeah, it's so funny. I mean, again, there's a lot of similarities there. I posted something on LinkedIn the other day, and this is completely true story. Like early on from my kids, I told them proud to be a Rashid, right? Creating kind of that, you know, setting a bar for yourself. You know, we are a tribe, like your name matters, and giving them that positivity about like you belong to something, we're doing something together. Is a very, very important thing. And I totally agree with you on the one-on-one. I have four kids and I'm so grateful I do, because they can bounce off each other. The relationships they have, the learnings they get from that is like so, so amazing. And yet getting time with each of them one-on-one. For example, one of the things I do is I like to take each of my daughters, my three oldest daughters, on a one-on-one daddy-daughter trip for a weekend to a place of their choice. And so as much as we're together and I like having the family together, I will go take them. Like I took one daughter to Washington, D.C. I took one daughter to New York. I took one to Austin, Texas. And we just go and we spend the weekend together, do the things that they want to do. And I know that they're forming these core memories that they're always going to have and building a deeper relationship with me one-on-one. And I think it's okay to single one of them out or give them that special time, as long as you try to balance it and then also have that collective time. So I couldn't agree with you more. I think that's a really, really key thing. And I love kind of the positivity you put into their mind early in the day about having an amazing day. You know, I like to visualize what my best day is when I'm in the morning and I'm meditating and thinking. And you'll be amazed at how much that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Even as bad things start to happen, you've still got that vision of what that perfect day looks like. So I think that's amazing. I really, really like that.
Just one funny story, because it came to my head, but on the one-on-one and the good bits they get, but also dealing with, you touched on it, like, for the ones who aren't one-on-one with you that day, things don't always go your way. You don't always get what you want. So I've got two season tickets to go and see Arsenal. I'm an Arsenal fan. I like to go and watch the football. And my eldest son's 10 and he's got used to coming all the time, you know, and it's really good one-on-one time, because we drive there, we park up, we walk to the stadium, we have something to eat, we watch the game. You know, it's an hour, hours and hours and hours of just hanging out. And then my seven-year-old Benji has become more and more interested. I think partly because he sees me going off with James and doing it, the two of us, and we're talking about it all the time. And he said, you know, I really, really want to go. And I was like, great, you'll come to the next game. And then James is saying, well, hang on a minute. I thought I was coming with you. And I said, well, you do. And you did. But we're going to take Benji. And I'm going to take Benji. And then we were walking to the match that I was with James. And he was saying, I remember when we came here when I was little. And I remember when we went to that cafe. And I remember when we parked over there. And I said, those are the memories that I want Benji to have. And those are the memories you should want him to have. And if he doesn't start coming now, he's not going to be able to form those memories. And I reminded him, then there's Harry. You know, Harry's only two. He's also going to want to come. So you're going to have to get used to the fact that, yeah, you like going and it's good we get to spend time together and it's something we've always done, but life doesn't always go your way.
Sometimes it doesn't always work out your way. You and I must have read from the same books because I totally agree with that. By definition, treating someone special means that some other people in that moment are going to feel a little bit left out, and that's okay. Sometimes it's okay to have that one-on-one and individual experience. I love that. So listen, I want to get to the speed round all of a sudden because I want to talk to you about cars, and I didn't know you were a Gunners fan. I am a diehard Liverpool fan, so I'm going to come back to that in a minute. Let's talk a little bit about hiring real quick. I want to understand, you know, you've grown multiple organizations now. You kind of have to identify great talent to help drive your business. Do you have a core hiring philosophy for when you're bringing people into your organization?
You know, I'm not sure I'm as good at it as I thought I was. And the reason is that you learn from every experience. So it's something I, to be perfectly honest with you, I'd like to get better at. I think it's the only thing that matters is the individual, their experience, their work ethic, you know, their grades, the previous companies they've worked for. I think all of those things go out the window when you don't have someone that wants to buy into the company, buy into the culture, believes in the product, believes in the people, wants to help everybody around them, bring them along. Because if you've got those type of skills, then when things go against you, which they do, as an individual, as a company, then you know how to claw yourself out of it. And I think what I've experienced in my career is when things are going well, everyone's great. You know, everyone's champion of the team. Everyone's happy to pull together. It's when the cracks start to appear, when things aren't going according to plan. And I think, you know, I found it difficult to keep people motivated in those times. And I think that's what I'd be looking for more in the future.
I love that. That is absolutely the right thing. Motivation, situation, that trumps, in my opinion, behavior, and especially experience. And like, those are things that a lot of times that you can train, that kind of motivation and that desire to buy in. That's when things get tough. That's when you know you're going to have somebody that's going to stick through it. So I think that's a really astute call out on your part. What about a memorable interview experience? Do you have anybody that maybe like wowed you in the interview, or maybe it wasn't a great interview? You don't got to name names, but any type of interview experiences that stand out to you as super memorable?
No, do you know what? I'd say probably the opposite. You know, business partner of mine and I, we always used to argue about that meeting's a waste of time. He'd always say to me, waste of time. I wouldn't bother that business. And I have found the opposite in my career, which is that no meeting is a waste of time. And I think it's a bit like reading books. I don't really have a book that I've obsessed over, but every book I've read or listened to, I've tried to take one positive thing and take it with me moving forward. And I think it's on the theme of the positivity and things we talked about. I don't think I would have ever got off a call or a podcast or an interview or a meeting and thought that bit was a waste of time. I'd be thinking, you know what? Of that whole hour, I picked up something that I might be able to take with me for the rest of my life.
Nice. I like that. Good mindset. What about when you're interviewing somebody for your company? Do you have a favorite question you like to ask? Or is there one that you think really gets to the heart of what you're looking for out of that person?
I think people being able to point out areas where they need help. I think someone who's honest enough to say, this is what I'm great at and this is where I would need help. I think that's super important, and nobody's good at everything. So for me, I was always taught to hire someone better than me to do the job that I need them to do. And there are loads of things that lots of people can do better than me. I always take sort of finances being the main area. I'm very financially astute, don't get me wrong. I understand finance and funding intimately, and I've got bucket loads of experience, but I'm not good at sitting in front of a spreadsheet for hours and hours and going through minutiae detail. I'm good at show me the thing and let me make a decision on, give me the information. So yeah, just trying to find people that are good, know what they're good at, and are happy to say when they need more help.
Love that. What about, so have you ever interviewed for a job? Because it sounds like you pretty early on, you started your own company and started running. Did you ever interview at any for any job?
You know, it's funny you should say that. I have not been asked this question for a very long time. I definitely said for a long time that I'd never been for an interview and not been offered a job. You know, when I mean, this might be interesting, it might not be, but when I've been for an, even at a very young age, when I went for a job interview, I remember very, very clearly thinking, you're not interviewing me, I'm interviewing you. Am I going to work for you? Do I believe in the product that you're selling me? Scrap the questions that you want to know about whether I'm going to, my grades, or I'll tell you whether I think you're a good enough company for me to come and dedicate more time to than I would be spending with my own children. That was always my mentality. So I always felt like I went in with 1,000 questions. Who are you? How'd you get here? What makes you think you can do this? Who else can I talk to in your firm that's worked for you for a long time? Who's the last person you hired? Who's the last person you fired? And why? Because I felt like I would be in sort of data gathering mode and trying to imagine myself working there. And I tried to tell my employees all the time, no question is a stupid question. Don't guess. Don't try and figure out. Don't think you know. If you don't know, ask. And that's kind of, again, just something that's been ingrained in me since I was young.
I love that. I don't know if that's a philosophy I'd recommend to everybody, but I think that really worked for you. And I would love that. If somebody comes in and they take over, because I agree with you, at best, it's a 50-50 proposition. We're interviewing you, but you're interviewing us, and you need to know what you're walking into. And if you're very talented, you're doing the same thing you're doing. You're making sure that where I spend my time is important. I want to make sure that I'm doing it in the worthwhile place, because there's nothing worse than going through an interview process and thinking that you've got a great job, a great company, a great manager. And then 2 weeks in, you're like, oh shit, this is not what I thought it was. And that's why you got to do your diligence on that side.
For sure.
So you mentioned earlier, you'd like to be better at hiring. All right, so I'll play ball. What's an area that you'd like to be better at? Is it the questions you ask? Is it the requirements? Is it creating an experience? Like, what are the areas that you'd like to see yourself improve?
Yeah, I think the questions you ask are important, for sure. And without question, without doubt, I could get better at that. I mean, to be perfectly honest, I haven't been on the front line hiring people for a long time because it's very formulaic and people go through the process. Maybe just that, thinking out loud, it's something I should be more involved with on the front line. I should be involved in the interview process more because it's something maybe I've taken a back seat from. I also think, I think what I've struggled with is I've always felt that I'm never going to know. People can interview really well. People are good at saying the right things in an interview. They're good at interviews. What I've found in my career is that people show up on Monday and they're not the person that they were the Monday before. Sure. When they shook your hands, they looked you in the eye and they told you these things were important to them. You know, time management, timekeeping, the basics. I feel like if, you know, you show up late for work on your first day, and it happens a lot, that's sort of really difficult to overcome. And I think the best and the positive, the best employees that I've got and that have been with me the longest, I feel like maybe there was a bit more luck involved than execution.
All right, so listen, now you're in my wheelhouse. I am not one to be on here selling things, but I will tell you this. We have built software for people and founders like you that don't have the time to put in a lot of pre-interview, post-interview, but they want to be able to ask the right questions. They want to create the right experience. And I actually believe you're going through something that many people struggle with, the idea that I interview somebody and then they're 50% less when I get them, or they misled me in the process. I do think there's types of questions and different things that you can do to dig into that a little bit deeper and maybe get some like fundamental examples or kind of read their body language on certain things. to get a little more certain, but I agree with you. It's hard to get it 100%. Some people are just professional interviews and they're really good, right, at like presenting themselves as something. And then when you get into the work, it's quite a different thing. And that's where I think motivation, situation, and stuff like that really, really plays in. So I will follow up with you on that. I think there's tools and technology that can help with that. We'll talk about that afterwards. Let's do this. I want to talk about a couple of other items, then I want to get into our speed round. What's something you're working on right now, Duncan, you're super excited about? Is there anything right now? I mean, it sounds like the fractional investment.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. I mean, that is literally it. And the reason it's still so interesting, it's like a big subject, but it narrows down into so many different bits. I think, you know, the most exciting bit of that I'm working on right now is I'm trying to acquire a business that I thought was the absolute shining light and the ones I wanted to catch at some point in my career. And for one reason or another, the stars have aligned and there's this opportunity for me to buy this business that hasn't been performing as well as it was. It's changed ownership. It's been a bit sleepy. Through a few chance encounters, I made an offer to acquire the business and I'm in exclusivity and I think it could be a game changer. It could, if I risk what I've done so far because I'm blind that this needs to be done, if the customers don't like the business, if there's problems with the regulator. So it's, you know, I'm sort of desperate to do it and I think I will. But also what's exciting is I don't know yet. It's just that the opportunity is there. And that is definitely...
This won't come out for a couple months. So if you're okay sharing this, let me know. Is it a tech play? Is it a customer acquisition play? Is it a talent play? Like, what are you looking at with the acquisition?
It's a tech and regulation play. It's actually, it's tech and customers, you know? So I look at the market and, you know, just talking about fractional ownership for a minute, one thing I feel sure about is we don't know who the customer is yet. So do people want to take their phone out and buy it? We don't know yet. Who's most likely to do that right now? We definitely don't know. So it's about me, that one of the reasons I'm attracted to this business is that they've convinced thousands of people to do this before. So I could go out and spend money on trying to acquire customers and understand who my cohort is, or I can go into this area where there's 10,000 customers that have transacted with the business before. And I feel like that's the most perfect audience to talk to about what I'm trying to do and why it's different from what they've done before. So there's that, and it's regulated and they've got a high form of regulation, which is difficult and expensive to obtain. Funnily enough, not a talent play, although I'm sure there are some talented people there. Really, it's more me leaning into the talent that I've acquired so far. And thinking if my team was doing that, that business would look very different.
Well, listen, like I think the idea is brilliant. I think at some point it will be the new way forward. I don't know much from a regulation perspective and the different hoops and things that you have to jump through. But if you can acquire a company that has already educated a lot of the customer base, has already built that cohort, already has kind of that technology touching the customers, I think that'd be awesome, man. So I'm pulling for you on that, and I hope that works out. Last question before we get to the speed round. What's some advice you'd give your 20-year-old self that you didn't know then, but that you know now? What would you tell 20-year-old Duncan if you had him and you could give him advice?
Block out what everybody else thinks and follow your gut. You know, fortunately, I'm one of, you know, I don't have any regrets. I haven't always made the best decisions at the best time, but I have learned from every decision and I would not change a single one of them. And I think, you know, it's also, I guess, what I would tell myself is to back myself even more. That don't be too cautious. You know, that what's the worst that can happen attitude. I've had a few times in my career where, you know, I've taken my chips off the table because I was weighing up the positives and negatives. And they were, you know, really good times for me. I think, you know, in hindsight, sometimes I was a bit nervous. I thought maybe this is my time. Maybe this is the time to cash in. So I would say, you know, leaning into all of the things that we've talked about today that I've learned and honed over those years.
That's awesome, man. Great advice. All right, let's do this because I'm excited to talk about this. So you are a car hobbyist. I see the car picture back there. I know it's a big passion of yours. So I'm going to ask some speed round questions. When did you first get into cars? How old were you?
When I was at school, you know, so sort of 10 to 15, I just wanted a 911. I just wanted a Porsche. I mean, my school teacher who I met recently said to me, I remember you saying, I want to buy a Porsche. It's not something, you know, it's hard to explain this. And I guess everyone just has to take me at face value, but it's not to show off with. I don't care what anybody else thinks. I don't care if you like it, you love it, you hate it, you hate me. It's for me. I get up in the morning, I drive a Porsche every day as my daily driver. When I wake up in the morning, there's a little piece of me that looks outside and thinks how great my day is going to be, thinks, you know what, I'm going to work in my dream car. And I think it gives me that extra bit of oomph. My favorite holidays are driving my car with the top down in the mountains and the sunshine. It wouldn't be most people's favorite holiday, but I guess from a very, very early age, I've always wanted a Porsche. And that has not died down at all.
So is that your most prized car, or do you have another prized car when I bring that up?
I've got a newfound obsession with Ferrari. So I was sort of one track Porsche minded for a very, very long time. And then I've just turned 40. So it's my 40th, but I say just, it was almost a year ago. I'm going to hang on to it for a while. But turning 40, I suddenly just had this like epiphany of, well, what are those little red cars that everybody talks about? I've never really paid much attention to that. In fact, I always said, no, they're not for me. I'm a Porsche guy. I've bought a lot of cars. I've owned 11 Porsche 911s in my life. And I still own three of them now. And I've started now looking at the red cars as well. So yeah. I own a couple of those as well.
So outside of a 911, what's your dream car? Is it the Ferrari Testarossa, or what's the Ferrari that you love?
So I've got a couple of Ferraris as well. But my dream car, I mean, look, your dreams, I've learned to dream big, and when you get there, have a new dream.
Let's
as well.
It. Come on, I want to hear this. What's the dream?
Yeah,
car?
I mean, look, I definitely, it's less of a dream. It's more of a when. You know, I think Bugatti is probably where I see myself going next. And, you know, apart from my kids' education, them being fed and having somewhere nice to sleep and getting to spend time together all the time, I guess what's having money for? And one thing is, I would like to get the balance right of having toys that I enjoy and investing wisely. So my kind of business mind and my car passion have collided. And I think it's less likely that I will buy a brand new car that will depreciate 50% overnight, and more likely that I'll save and save and save and save and push myself to buy something that I think could be worth double when my children are old enough to look in the garage and think, can I have a go in that?
I love it. So what's the craziest thing you've ever done to indulge this passion? Trips or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I go on road trips. I've done 10 years in a row. I've been on road trips around Europe. I've been through Italy, Germany, France, Slovenia, Croatia, all through the mountains, every mountain pass. I mean, every road trip I go on is an adventure. But you know, I've on a whim gone and bought like a super cool crazy car, and those have been the best decisions of my life.
Love that. All right, let's take this in another direction. Speaking of dreams, what are the chances Arsenal wins the Premier this league this year?
100%.
Okay, so I gotta tell you, I went to Anfield 2 years ago. It was a Saturday night game. It was against the Gunners. It was 4-0. It was an amazing, rocking run, and the stadium was, and you know how it goes at Anfield.
You're breaking up a bit, Oz. Can't hear you very well.
Oh, I bet. Who's your favorite Gunner of all time?
I mean, Ian Wright, basically, who I grew up with. Ian Wright, right. But Thierry Henry, just as a personality. You know, I guess a lot of the footballers I watched, I just talk to my sons about this all the time. I was like, I remember watching him. He was great. And I think Thierry does an incredible job of how he composes himself, his just level of, you know, there's like an air of brilliance about the man, the way he conducted himself, record breaker, as good a footballer as I ever watched in real life.
Yeah, so what was your favorite season of all time, the undefeated, invincible season?
Yeah, gotta be, yeah. Got to be. I mean, I hope my kids get to see us win the league as well. Who's your favorite footballer of all time?
I'm a Liverpool fan. We tied recently. You guys, Saka ended up playing, had a nice goal. You were down a couple, but we were down a couple. But it was at the Emirates. So I feel good about getting that 1 point there. And like, we're looking really good. Like right now with Klopp and the transition to Slot, almost always, like think about when Wagner left, right? Or think about when Sir Alex left, right? Yeah. There was a humongous drop off.
Oh, and he Slot's done enough.
I'm feeling really good about Slot right now.
Who's your favorite player of all time then?
Yeah, so I only started watching in 2014. So I'm a Bobby Firmino and Suarez were my two favorite Liverpool players. Because I love Gerrard, don't get me wrong, but I only started following in like 2014, 2015. And so watching Suarez play and then Bobby Firmino, I obviously love Salah. I love Van Dijk. I'm a big Liverpool guy. I'm probably going to go out to a game. I think what I should do is I'd give you a call. And next time we're playing in London, I'll come visit you and we'll go watch a game together.
100%. Let's definitely do that. I'd really appreciate that. That'd be good fun.
Duncan, been amazing, man. I appreciate you coming on. Good luck with everything with Tab. I know we're going to stay in contact after this.
We are.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much. Let me know if I can help with anything, yeah?
All right, brother. Talk to you later.
Bye-bye.